Catherine Amirfar.
And I'm Cal Rousdiala.
And this is
International Law Behind the Headlines,
coming to you from
the American Society of International Law.
Welcome to International Law Behind the Headlines. This is Catherine Amirfar, and I'm here and in conversation with Dr. Christina Voigt. We're going to be talking about Paris Agreement and in particular, the latest COP28. But before I start, I want to give our listeners a sense of Dr. Voigt, of Christina, as I know her. She is a professor of law at the University of Oslo, Norway. She's internationally renowned expert in international environmental law and teaches, speaks, and publishes widely on legal issues of climate change, on environmental multilateralism, and sustainability. And we're going to have the benefit of this conversation from her experience as the principal legal advisor for the government of Norway in the UN climate negotiations, during which she negotiated the Paris Agreement and its rulebook. Professor Voigt is the chair of the IUCN World Commission on Environmental Law and co-chair of the Paris Agreement Implementation and Compliance Committee. Welcome. Welcome, Christina. It's just a real pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure for me too.
So on climate change, I think it's hardly an issue for which I need to set the stage. Obviously, we've all come off one of the, I believe, the hottest year in recorded history, with ocean temperatures reaching all-time highs in some places. The UN Secretary General has commented in recent days that we have reached an era of global boiling. And so I think it's safe to say that climate change and the potential catastrophic consequences that scientists have been warning us all about for literally decades is very much top of mind. So, Christina, I want to turn to you first as really taking advantage of the more than 10 years that you spent as a negotiator for the government of Norway in UN climate change negotiations. In the context that I know that negotiations have taken us far, but perhaps not far enough in terms of what countries need to do to avert the most catastrophic consequences of GHG emissions and what it's doing in terms of global warming and global boiling as it is. So could you speak and start with your role in your capacity as a negotiator at UN climate change conferences known as COPs? What were some of the challenges you faced? What are you most proud of?
Well, thanks again, Catherine, for inviting me. And thanks for that particular question. What are the COPs is maybe the first question to address. The climate meetings, the conference of the parties, is a big gathering of all the parties to the international climate treaties that we have. That's the Framework Convention on Climate Change, and in particular then the Paris Agreement, which have over 190 parties, 195 parties to the Paris Agreement. And all these countries gather once a year, usually for 2 weeks at the end of the year, somewhere in the world, to negotiate and to assess progress in implementing those agreements. Now, your question of what are the challenges and what I have been most proud of, it's a difficult one. It's a long list of challenges. I think the most pressing challenge is that climate change is an issue that needs urgently to be addressed. Like you just said, Catherine, we are looking at increasing mean temperatures, entered the era of global boiling, and we have a very small and very fastly closing window of opportunity to really turn things around. And we don't see measures taken or policies implemented at the speed that is required. I think that's the biggest challenge, that disconnect between the urgency of the issue and the slow pace of policy making and implementation. But the second question, what I'm most proud of, I guess that's really the negotiation and the adoption of the Paris Agreement. The Paris Agreement on climate change is really the international legal tool that we have as an international community of states to address that global challenge of climate change. And having this in place is, I think, has been the highlight of my career, having negotiated this and now also being the chair of the Compliance Committee for the agreement. But what is now urgently needed is really a fast implementation across all sectors and a very speedy implementation of that agreement. And that's something I think that we're still are waiting to see.
Thank you. And before we turn to implementation, because I want to focus on where we are as a world community, tell me, how has your role shifted since you've taken on the new position as co-chair of the Paris Agreement's Compliance and Implementation Committee?
That's quite a significant shift, because if you go to these climate meetings under the United Nations as a delegate, as a negotiator for a party, you, of course, have to represent that party and that party's position. And you try to negotiate in the interest of a particular state that you represent. Now, being the co-chair of the Compliance and Implementation Committee, as it is called, is a completely different function, because there I don't represent one particular party, but I'm guiding and steering a standing body, a constituted body under the Paris Agreement with 24 people from all over the world. And we have to find agreement. And the role of a chair, role of a co-chair, I have a co-chair from Pakistan, Haseeb Goha, is, of course, to facilitate agreement within that committee, which is a very different role than, you know, representing your particular country. It's quite the opposite. Really, you try to get everyone together and find that common ground that enables the committee to move forward.
Certainly. And let's talk about some of the points of common ground, because I'd like to talk about where we are in the last COP28, which was mm-hmm. last year and obviously concluded on December 13th of last year. So it was a landmark COP in lots of ways, but it also, I think, and based including on commentators and some criticism from commentators, a bit of a mixed bag and some shortcomings. But if we take a step back, and you mentioned, Christina, being proud of having negotiated the Paris Agreement. And I think from my perspective, that is certainly an important milestone event. And one of the greatest innovations and contributions of the Paris Agreement, in my view, is the idea of the NDCs, the nationally determined contributions, that states must come to the table in this collective forum for discussion to find common ground with a commitment to progressively ambitious nationally determined contributions, which get us to where the scientists tell us we need to be to avert the most catastrophic consequences. And in that context, you hear, of course, a lot about the 1.5 degree threshold in terms of the rise in average global temperature, as that being a very significant threshold from a scientific perspective. Now, these NDCs collectively taken, though, even if implemented, don't get us to the 1.5. In fact, they get us closer to a 2 degree and maybe even beyond a 2 degree average temperature rise, which all the scientists agree would be absolutely catastrophic for not just fragile ecosystems, but for human systems, for environmental systems across the globe. So taking a step back, we come to COP28 knowing that the NDCs, even if implemented on a global scale, are not enough. We come into COP28 with a sense and a criticism that there's a lack of ambition and the deferral of important steps. With that table setting, can you tell us from your perspective, what are your reactions to COP28? What, in your view, were the most promising outcomes? Where do you see the shortcomings?
Let's pick up a little bit on what you just described, Catherine, which is very helpful as a segue to COP28. The NDCs is the most important tool, is the core legal obligation that parties have under the Paris Agreement to communicate an NDC every 5 years. And it's very important to remember that these NDCs are not a one-time off. They are supposed to be communicated every 5 years. And that really kicks in motion in 2025 and in 2030, 2035, and so forth. We haven't really seen that process moving forward in the way it is designed. And the whole idea, as you also pointed to, is that every time parties put forward a new NDC, it has to progress in relation to the previous one, and it has to reflect each party's highest possible ambition. But that's not the only thing. In addition to that, parties also come together every 5 years, and it's always 2 years before the next round of NDCs are due. 2 years prior to that, parties come together to collectively assess progress in implementing the goals of the Paris Agreement. And that's the global stocktake that for the first time took place this year, last year in 2023, and it will take place again in 2028 and so forth, always 2 years prior to the next NDC. And the whole idea about this global stocktake is to see where parties collectively are. And there will never be enough action. There will always be a gap. And that gap is supposed to inform parties' next round of NDC so that they know what they can do, how they can improve, how they can progress. They have to take note and take into account the outcome of the global stocktake as an ambition tool or pusher to increase ambition in their next round of NDCs. And so the importance of COP28 from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates last December is exactly that outcome of the first global stocktake, which was difficult to negotiate. It was very controversial. It took one more day than initially planned, but parties agreed on a long list of global efforts that need now to be broken down to domestic efforts. And amongst them, we have, of course, the transitioning away from fossil fuels in energy system, but also many other things that now are meant to inform parties in their preparation for communicating the next NDC. And the NDC, as I said, is due in 2025, 9 to 12 months prior to the COP in 2025, which is in November in Brazil, which means that already in February, but 1 year from now, less than 1 year from now, every single party has to communicate its new NDC in light of the global stocktake. And I think that's a very important outcome, a very important link. But it's not the only one from COP28. There are many other elements, in particular also the operationalization or the operating guidelines for the loss and damage fund. Very important decision that was taken at the very first day of the COP is a significant way forward as well.
Thank you. Let me stick with the first global stocktake, because as you say, it was momentous. I know that before COP28, you had made public statements to the effect that the global stocktake was the most important part of the conference and that it was important to get that right. And as you say, there is a laundry list that came out of the global stocktake that will inform the next round. I guess my question to you is, did we get it right? Did that list reflect the priorities? Is the timing consistent with the urgency of the issue?
I think it is a good list. I mean, it cannot be too prescriptive, right? It is something that every single state then has to relate to and break down to its national circumstances and also emission portfolio capacities and what have you. But I think the message is right. In particular, the strong focus on 1.5 degrees threshold, as we all know in the Paris Agreement, there's a reference to well below 2 degrees, pursuing efforts to 1.5 degrees. It wasn't always clear that 1.5 degrees is the threshold that matters, but that is very clearly coming through in the global stocktake outcome. The second important point is that there's also a very specific pathway now outlined to get there, talking about emission reductions around 45% in 2030, 60% in 2035. That's a significant increase in only 5 years, and then reaching net zero around 2050. So that pathway on which every single country now can orient itself and the global community as a whole are very important pointers of where we all collectively need to go in order to stand a chance to keep warming to somewhere close to 1.5 degrees. And then that long list of global efforts that the decision contains are very important pointers of what kind of measures, what kind of actions need to be taken. We find reference to phasing out of insufficient subsidies for fossil fuels, phasing down of unabated coal, and then, of course, transitioning away from fossil fuels and energy system. But in addition to that, we find also very important references to the conservation of nature, protection of forest, reforestation, a global goal of halting deforestation by 2030, because it's understood that protecting nature, protecting things, is a very important aspect of getting to net zero and reaching 1.5 degrees or the threshold in 2050. So I think the overall message is a very important one. But of course, it could have been stronger, and there were expectations that it would have been stronger, and there was some disappointment by some parts or some parties. But overall, I think the message is right.
And certainly the pathway and to net zero in 2015 certainly did come out as a very important message from that first stock take. Let me go back to something else you mentioned, which is the Loss and Damage Fund, which for our listeners was really a momentous occasion when it was set up following COP27. Could you tell us a bit more about how COP28 progressed the fund and its work?
Sure. The Paris Agreement itself, in its Article 8, recognizes that there is the possibility of loss and damages associated with climate change, and recognizes that this is an issue that needs to be addressed. But in the Paris Agreement, there isn't much detail on how to do it. And in the decision that adopted the Paris Agreement is actually a waiver for liability and compensation under the loss and damage article. So the whole issue of loss and damage has been a little bit dormant for several years. And against that background, it was a really important step forward when in 2022 at the COP in Egypt in Sharm el-Sheikh, the parties agreed at the establishment of a loss and damage fund. But this is also everything, all that happened in Sharm el-Sheikh was just the agreement to establish the fund, but all the rules around it were not in place. It was unclear who would be paying into that fund, who could get money from that fund, and for what purpose. Everything was open. So between the COP in Egypt and the COP in the United Arab Emirates, so between 2022 and 2023, there was a transitional committee, as it was called, which worked out the more specific rules for that fund. And it was really, really difficult negotiations. And against that background, I think it was a big surprise, a positive surprise, that the decision was adopted really right away at the first day of the COP on the rules and the guidelines for that fund, so that it's now clearer how that fund is supposed to work, who would be paying into it, for what purposes can be applications made to receive money, in particular the most vulnerable or particularly vulnerable developing countries, and how is it being operated. The decision was that it would be the World Bank in the interim until a board and a secretariat is established. But all these details were not in place in Egypt, and they finally now came in place in Dubai, and I think that's a very important success and important outcome from Dubai as well.
Great. So let's turn to kind of the outcomes and looking forward from Dubai to COP29 this year, which will be taking place in Baku in Azerbaijan. What do you think are the key issues that haven't been addressed or not sufficiently addressed that need to roll over to COP29 in Baku? What are the most important points from your perspective that COP29 needs to progress?
I think we may we may not want to expect too much from every single COP. I think the answer to the climate challenge doesn't lie in an annual COP. That's the meeting and of the parties, and you know, some decisions need to be taken. But I think the answer really lie in the national implementation, the national measures that states now have to take on their own climate policies. And the guidelines for that is in place. But coming back to COP29 in Baku in Azerbaijan later this year, the importance of that COP lies in a finance-related decision. When the Paris Agreement was adopted, there was an agreement that developed country parties would mobilize $100 billion annually for developing countries, for mitigation, adaptation, action in developing countries. And that goal was for the first time more or less achieved last year. And it's, as I said, an annual target, $100 billion. But this year, a new finance goal has to be adopted. There's a clear mandate for parties to negotiate and to adopt a new finance goal with the $100 billion as the floor. So we know that's the starting point, but we don't know where the ceiling is. And I followed these negotiations a little bit, very difficult negotiations as well.
Yes.
And the numbers flying around there are trillions now. And I think trillions is perhaps also the adequate sum, given the massive costs and massive impacts that we're already seeing with respect to climate change. But this is why the COP29 in Baku is already titled the finance COP, because that particular decision on a new global finance goal is to be taken, and that's going to be difficult, and we're probably looking at several days of of yes. delay and going over time, but it's an important one.
So let me circle back to another point that you made around compliance, because as we know, compliance on a national level is really everything, and the proof is in the pudding. So this also dovetails, of course, with your work and your very important work, along with your co-chair on the Compliance and Implementation Committee. How does that committee ensure compliance?
Well, let me step back one or two steps before I answer your question, Catherine. Mm-hmm. First of all, what does this committee do? What is the mandate of the committee? It is it was established in the Paris Agreement itself, and the idea is to have a body established, an independent body that can check on whether parties actually implement and comply with their legal obligations under the Paris Agreement. Now, the legal obligations under the Paris Agreement are not very many. There are a few. Yeah. And far in between.
Yes.
And one of them is the one that you already mentioned, is that parties need to put forward their nationally determined contributions, their NDCs. But they also have to report on them every other year, and then a couple of other obligations. So the compliance committee is in a way tailored designed to fit in its mandate to the design and the architecture of the Paris Agreement. So the committee can check whether parties communicate NDCs, whether they submit their mandatory reports. And if that's not the case, if there, for example, is a party without an NDC, the committee can reach out to that party. Committee can establish a dialogue and basically ask what's the problem, what's going on, in order to find out what the issues are. Is it capacity? Is it just missing knowledge about the deadline? There can be many different reasons. Though in many cases, that's already enough to solve the issue. If it's not, then the committee can engage further. If it is a capacity issue, if it's a financial issue or technology issue, the committee can help the party in question to get in contact with the specialized bodies under the Paris Agreement. But the committee can also work with the party concerned on a compliance action plan, how to get back into compliance, and follow up on that. And the final measure that the committee can take is a public statement. That's like the measure of last resort, is a public statement that party X is not in compliance. And that may sound like a very loose and gentle measure, but in international relations, it is not, because states do not like to be called upon and to be the subject of a public statement. There's a lot of reputational cost at stake. But the committee has that possibility, that function to make non-compliance known. On the downside, it doesn't have any real legal teeth. It cannot enforce its findings. There is no possibility to suspend, for example, participation in carbon trading or something like this. But we'll see how the committee will or hopefully induce parties' compliance. We had our first two cases last year, and it was enough that the committee just sent a letter, and within a couple of weeks, the issues were resolved just because of the outreach from the committee.
I think that's a really important point that you say, Christina, in the sense that oftentimes people, I think, underrate the importance of what it means for a public statement of non-compliance directed at a particular state and what that means and translates into in terms of the international plane. So I think that that's a very important role of the committee. But as you say, it is a lot of trying to figure out what are the challenges to compliance and removing obstacles in as much as the international community can. So a very, very important role. So I want to turn from all of this to something more personal for the many people listening who want to take effective action to address climate change and its impacts, but frankly, feel overwhelmed in thinking about this as really a global issue for which it's very difficult to think about how individual action matters. But you have been in the trenches on this issue for decades. There are many people who want to know what they can do to take effective action in their communities. What advice would you give them?
That's a really difficult question, Catherine, because climate, and I get this question a lot. Yeah. I speak sometimes at schools, and then you have this group of young people in front of you asking, what can we do? And it always makes me sad, because I think it shouldn't be you, right? It should be us. It should be the generation who caused that problem. But there are all these kids who wonder what they can do, and individuals in general. But it's tricky, because it's such a compound challenge, right? It's so complex and interconnected. And I think for that reason, it's very important to break down those international targets, the very abstract 1.5 degrees, and think through what it means domestically. What does it mean on a state level? What can it mean on a city level? Really break it down and find out what could be also be the policy tools, the legal tools that could then implement these breakdown bits and pieces of those overarching targets. I think targeting transport, targeting energy system is very important. Switching to renewables, of course, is the crux in addressing climate change, moving away from fossil fuels. But it's very difficult to do this as an individual, right, as a single person, because you need to have in place governmental interventions to make sure that everybody is moving in the same direction. Otherwise, it will come to the cost of some and to the benefit of others who may not want to be moving forward. It's a tricky issue, but I think what individuals can do is always try to save power, try to save energy, protect things, protect forests, very important aspects in the overall carbon budget that we have. And there are many aspects that individuals can contribute with when it comes to protecting nature as a part of the climate solution. But in general, I think what is most important is to exercise the political pressure that stakeholders can do, that individuals can exert, and make sure that the right decisions are taken by those in office and in power.
That certainly makes sense. And of course, it's that classic issue of a problem that is so pervasive and so interrelated that it requires global collective action to be effective. And yet I do think, and I take your point, individuals matter. I myself was heartened by the future generations who, as you say, they didn't cause the problem, but I think they are certainly key to the solution. And one prime example is the initiative by Vanuatu and the International Court of Justice to seek the advisory opinion that started, obviously, and had to be a motion really before the General Assembly. But I note that that movement started as a youth movement. It was a collection of youth across the globe that tapped into a community, tapped into a voice, and was able to unify that action sufficiently to create a wave of state political will in the General Assembly that ultimately, as you know, resulted in the referral to the International Court of Justice on the advisory opinion related to climate change. So just an example of how powerful the next generation can be in helping us find the solution. So a positive note, I suppose, on a very difficult issue.
Absolutely. And actually, I can tell that I spent the entire day today, and this hour is very welcome because it's a very brief respite on putting the last changes and last edits on the submission to the ICJ on behalf of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, which is authorized to participate in these proceedings. But it's going to be very interesting, Catherine. Thanks for pointing it out. It's going to be very interesting to see and to follow what the highest judicial organ of the UN system has to say about states' obligations to protect the climate system for present and future generations. And I think that future generation aspect is a very, very important one.
Christina, I want to say thank you so much. This was really, I think, very, very helpful in terms of crystallizing some of the key points and really the ambitions, including in what's to come this year with respect to climate change. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Catherine. It was a pleasure.